Good afternoon, Rabbi Othai. We're going to be reviewing this past semester of fall 2019 contemporary halacha. We're going to begin with reviewing the shiur of Rabbi Neuberger, the halachas of fasting on Yom Kippur. So first of all, the Mishnah Berurah points out that a rav has to have hilchos chol on Yom Kippur at his fingertips, and of course the Yerushalmi points out that if a person in a community asks the rav a shaila that relates to pikuach nefesh, it's the rav's fault because he didn't properly educate the community about a suffix pikuach nefesh is to be acted upon immediately. Let's talk about the rules for eating, drinking, specifically dehydration. Dehydration of any human being is a potential pikuach nefesh, whether you're pregnant or not pregnant, whether you're elderly or young. We're going to now talk, though, about a healthy muberes. A healthy muberes, presumably, the Mishnah says, and the Shulchan Aruch paskins so, that a muberes has to fast Yom Kippur. It happens to be that any doctor who is not very firm will probably tell their patients, oh, fasting is dangerous, don't fast, and that's why you might get calls on Erev Yom Kippur or hopefully a week before Yom Kippur, as you should tell your Baal Batim to check with you. My doctor said I can't fast. And you'll ask, do you have any elevated risk factors? No. Do you have anything wrong? No. Do you have any history of anything? No. So why did she say you can't fast? She said, oh, it's just not good for a pregnant woman to fast. So you say, thank you very much. If there's any issues, then I'm happy to talk to your doctor, but barring any issues, we follow the Mishnah and the Shulchan Aruch that says that we fast, that a pregnant woman fasts in Yom Kippur. Of course, it's important to realize that if there is danger to either mother or fetus is a machlokas Rishonim, but we do paskin, depends on how you say l'hakka l'hachmi, we do paskin that saving the life of a fetus does warrant chilul Shabbos d'oraisa, and of course eating on Yom Kippur. That is how we pass it, and we pass that is true even before 40 days after conception. Now, it is important to realize before we go into this discussion that when the Gemara talks about hakal hakal tchila, that you have to violate as little violation as possible, so we always will try to do shiurim, give little amounts of liquids or solids as opposed to larger amounts, so there's no thief kares. Keep in mind that even shiurim are Aser Mida Araisa. There are many frum doctors who have been practicing in the frum community for decades who think that eating pachas mikashir is only Aser Darabanan, and that is wrong. Eating pachas mikashir is Aser Daraisa, and you're only allowed to eat pachas mikashir on Yom Kippur if you are a cholesh yesh bo sakana. If it's dangerous enough that you have to drive to the hospital, call Hatzal on Shabbos, then you can have pachas mikashir. It's not just like, oh, I'm really thirsty, I'm really tired, I'll just have a little sip. Chas v'shalom, that's an Isser Daraisa, although Karis, of course, would only be limited to somebody who has, of course, the shear. So, let's begin with a fascinating psak mechudosh of Dayan Yaakov Yisrael Fisher. In Yerushalayim, he used to have the sit in the badatz, and when he would be sitting, he'd have a long line outside his badatz, because all the women wanted to get his psak, because he held that nowadays, fasting on Yom Kippur for Mu'ubaros is dangerous because our Mu'ubaros are weaker, we have a weaker constitution, and he claims that many Mu'ubaros have had hapalos, have had miscarriages, so therefore all pregnant women until the ninth month should eat pachas mikashir on Yom Kippur. So the poskim have rejected this leniency strongly in three primary ways. Number one, that Dayan Fisher's data is presumably questionable or even incorrect, because he says nechleshu adoros, we're not as strong as we used to be. So I don't know if that's true. We probably eat much more healthfully. We have probably much better nutrition than previous generations. Number two, you say that many women have had problems with pregnancy. Well, first of all, there is data from a number of experiments that they found that women typically there's no significant statistical change of danger of a baby of being born because of a mother fasting, pretty much practically minimal statistical significance. And third of all, and secondly in this point about the data, you might have included in that statement that many women have had hapalos, that might have included people who taka shouldn't have fast. If you indeed have a high risk situation that shouldn't have fasted, so of course they shouldn't fast. But we're talking about a regular healthy woman, don't apply statistics that might have included people who should never have fasted in the first place to a regular woman. Finally, thirdly, when you deal with a safek pikuach nefesh, it doesn't just mean that if it's one in ten, you live from Mechal Shabbos. But one in a million, one in a billion, that doesn't reach the threshold of what constitutes Safek Bikoach Nefesh. So even if you say that there are a number of women who have had hapalos, miscarriages, because of fasting, that doesn't mean there's still hundreds of thousands of women throughout generations of Jewish women, or millions of Jewish women who have fasted on Yom Kippur, and therefore, even if we say, says the Maharam Shik, that there is a sex sake, of course, does warrant Chilul Shabbos, but if it's the tiniest enough suffix, more, you know, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 50,000, that could cause, that might not reach the threshold of suffix Bikoach Nefesh. And finally, lastly, the Rosh Hashanah points out that even if you say that there is an Ishtanu HaTvayim that happened here, women's nature did indeed change over the course of the years, but what right do you have, Diane Fisher, to say that the nature has changed without a yeshivas basin of the Gedolim of the Chachmei Hador? We have a din mefurish, or the Mishnah din mefurish of the Shulchan Aruch, to just say Nishtana Tivium is a little too far. And therefore, the poskim are not willing to accept this kula of Diane Fisher. Now, let's talk about circumstances where the lady calls you up, says, I'm pregnant, and you have to ask her questions that, given certain circumstances, you would tell her that maybe she should drink a little bit Pachas Mikashir. So, of course, if it's a risk to either her or her baby, even before 40 days, she would drink. In general, it's important to know that the ikar here is hydration, not food. You could go for many days without eating and you will live. You might lose a little weight, which could be good for a lot of people. But the issue here is really the hydration. So number one, if a woman encountered two undiagnosed miscarriages, or if there was even one miscarriage that might be linked to dehydration, so that would warrant breaking her fast. Number two, if she's at risk for a preterm delivery, that would also make her in a high risk factor. Maybe she should, you know, drink a little bit. Number three, if there's preterm labor pains, so if she has pains, then we're worried that maybe if it's before the time the baby should be coming out, if it's the ninth month, we'll talk about later, but if there's preterm pains, then we're worried that this could cause danger. Sometimes you have a lady that even when she's not pregnant, she's prone to dehydration. Kavachomer, now that she is going to be pregnant, so you have to, you know, see if one of the questions I always ask is, do you have a history of dehydration in general on fast days? As far as if a woman vomits while she's during her pregnancy, which women do, if a woman vomits once or twice, I understand that there's no risk of dehydration, but once a woman vomits three times, she is at a risk of dehydration. Of course, if a woman on Yom Kippur is showing signs of dehydration right now, present, not, I'm worried there will be dehydration, but there's present signs of dehydration, so then we have, what are the signs of dehydration? The main sign, of course, is the urine is of amber color, accompanied with, you know, obviously, dehydration is not yes or no. It starts gradually, and it gets progressively worse and worse and worse, and obviously, if, you know, it's at 5 p.m., right around Ne'ilah's beginning, she says, oh my gosh, my urine is amber. So you say, okay, hang out, you know, hang in there for another hour and a quarter and you'll drink, you'll make a cup of dal, you'll be fine. But we're talking about something that's, you know, earlier in the day, and there's some of the signs of, some of the early signs of dehydration are a very bad headache, an unusual headache, like a dehydration headache. Everyone gets little headaches when we're fasting, but heart palpitations, faintness or dizziness, even when you're sitting, like if a woman is faint or dizzy when she stands up, so don't stand up, let her lie down. If there's a shift in fetal movement, you don't feel any, you know, the baby hasn't kicked in a long time. So in such cases, of course, we would say there's a chashash that we would encourage her to drink. It's important to know the Chasam Sofer, who says that it's more important to stay in bed and not go to shul and miss Tefillah B'Tzibur and miss Kriyas HaTorah and miss everything B'Tzibur and the whole emotional excitement of Yom Kippur davening than to go to shul. And says Rosh Shlomo Zalman, even if one pachos mikashir could be avoided by her staying in bed the entire Yom Kippur, that is preferable. And this is a conversation I have every year, and I'll tell the story that I've told before. I had a lady who I was speaking to, she wasn't pregnant, but some other issue. And I said, okay, so basically this Yom Kippur, you're going to go to sleep right after Sudam HaSekes, and you're going to stay in bed for the next 25 hours. And you're not going to daven, you're not going to go to shul, you're not going to do anything. You're just going to stay in bed in an air-conditioned room, and you're going to fast. And she said, Rabbi Orlean, What you're telling me is against everything that I ever learned in my entire day school career. I said, I guess they didn't cover the Chasam Sofer in your day school. Yeah, fasting on Yom Kippur is important. So even if it's without the emotions and the viduis and the singing and the without the singing, still Yom Kippur is fasting. Another situation where a woman would have to break her fast if she has early bleeding. Again, if there's anything you could talk to a doctor a few days before Yom Kippur, that makes life much easier. So as, when you become Rabbanim, you should make it a policy that you should send out an email or a message to the shul and may announce in shul 3 weeks before. If anybody has shailas about fasting, please contact me, because it's going to take them a week to realize and get back to you. Then it's going to take you a few days to reach there to talk to them about it. Then you have to talk to the doctor about it. Then you have to talk to them about it. Then they're going to ask a question. You have to go back and forth sometimes with the doctor and with them. So that takes time. You don't want all those conversations Erev Yom Kippur. Finally, if a woman is having pain during the ninth month, so hey, ninth month, she's having labor pains, great, let her have a baby. So here we have a question, if a woman is having labor pains in the ninth month, should she eat or should she not eat? On one hand, let her have the baby. That's what Diane Fisher says. Even though he says you could eat 1 through 8, but in the ninth month, you're about to have the baby, you don't need to eat. Let her have the baby, because that's, hey, I'm not worried if the lack of eating, the fasting will generate a labor. She's ready to have labor. But Rav Nevensal says even if she's in the ninth month, she still needs to have strength to push the baby out, have strength to give birth. And, you know, practically, halach l'maisa, you could sort of evaluate at which point in the day. If a woman, you know, has labor pains, you know, an hour after kol nidri, so she just stuffed her face 2 hours ago, so she doesn't need any food. She has plenty of food. If she has labor pains or contractions, you know, 5 p.m., in, you know, after mincha on Yom Kippur day, you know, right during Maftir Yonah, she's having contractions, so then she might taka need some nourishment and some hydration to give her the strength to push the baby out. Now, as far as shiurim, so the Chasam Sofer says that 9 minutes will certainly be safe. The poskim will point out that that's, you know, the safest bet, but if necessary, then one can be makel even to have the shiur in 6 minutes, in 5 minutes, in 4 minutes, in 3 minutes perhaps. What is the shiur? So food and machal, food and drink are totally separated, and just because you have food, that means, doesn't mean, you know, they're two separate areas. So when it comes to food, it's a grogeres, which is, again, food is less the issue, so I'm not going to talk about it so much now, but more liquids. Liquid is a malo lugmav. How much is a malo lugmav? Well, everybody's malo lugmav is different. Mishnah Berurah says the ideal way, says like it's a rov revius. Rov revius is 3.3 ounces, so rov revius would be 1.7 ounces. But the Mishnah Berurah suggests that the ideal way is to test it before Yom Kippur. How do you do that? Says Mishnah Berurah, you tell the person to fill both cheeks filled with liquid, and spit that entire quantity into a cup. 50% of that would be one cheekful, which is Malo Lugmav. That's the shear of Malo Lugmav. So the reason why it's kedai to check is because if you tell a lady, yeah, you could do 1.7 ounces or one shot glass, which is what we usually tell people, just take a shot glass and you'll be safe. It could be that she would do a check before Yom Kippur, depending on the size and the flexibility of her cheeks, she might be able to get twice as much in her pachas mikas shear. So if she actually does this measurement before Yom Kippur, sometimes the shalas come up on Yom Kippur, it's too late, but it is in your best interest to measure before Yom Kippur. Okay, if a person has a choice to either start fasting, but if they're going to break their fast, they're going to have to eat full shiurim, or the other option would be to just not have to have a shiur at all, but have pachas mikas shiur as Yom Kippur goes. So this is a discussion, but Rabbi Neuberger suggests that, he quotes Rosh Shlomo Zalman, he pays a frank with Vosner, that even if there's an outside chance that she'll make it to the fasting, she should try to fast. If it happens that she needs to break her fast, okay, she'll do whatever she needs at that point. But if you know mitchil, that she's definitely going to need to drink over the course of this day, then indeed it's better to start with pachas mikas shiur. Yes, it's lahachmi. Checking beforehand is going to be completely relative to the individual, but it's never really going to be less than that amount. Okay, so let's talk about, we finished a pregnant woman, let's talk about a nursing woman. The nursing women, your goal is to not make the woman lose her liquids because she's giving it to her baby through her milk. But if you advise her or you teach in shul a few weeks before that the nursing women should save up their milk, they should pump and save up their milk in just like women who go to work do, in the freezer where milk freezes wonderfully, then you and you train your baby to take a bottle, so then you could alleviate the need for a woman to be worried about the baby not getting nourishment. Ladies don't always like to do that, but that's what you should teach ahead of time so they have the time to make a little bit of a storehouse. Let's say, and if a baby taka gets aggravated on Yom Kippur, so give from the form, give this frozen milk. If there's no milk that you saved up from beforehand, so give formula. Oh, you want your baby to have just regular milk? Breast milk? Okay, I'm sorry. Obviously, that's not how you tell it to the woman at hand. However, let's say there's a situation where the baby just doesn't take formula, doesn't take a bottle, and the mother is dry because she hasn't drunk in, 14 hours, and the baby is, crying. And it's not just like you have a 45 minutes till the end of the fast. You have another 5 hours. So then, and just about only then, would we allow a mother to drink if the taka is no other option. But again, most situations, especially when caught ahead of time, you could mitigate the need for this to happen. It's important to know that a lot of people don't know that if somebody needs to take a pill on Yom Kippur, that's not considered breaking their fast. So even if a person has just a regular headache, kol shem bo sakana, they could, pop a Tylenol, make sure that you don't use Advil, because Advil is sucralose coated, and therefore it's akshave to be considered like a Michael because of the sugar coating. But if you have a generic brand Advil, or you have aspirin or Tylenol, you could swallow that without any water, that's fine. If a person does need water to take a pill, so then the post can say that we're asked on Tisha B'Av, you could just take it with a little bit of water. The water is not considered breaking the fast because it's just to help you take the pill. When it comes to Yom Kippur, we're more machmir. We say you have to foul the water. The typical way that I suggest to foul the water is you take not a shot glass with detergent, but a big pitcher, and you fill it with water and put a little bit of detergent in it so that all the water has a little foul flavor, and then take one, whatever shot glass you use from that water to help the pill go down, but the water has to be fouled a little bit on Yom Kippur. I had a lady 2 years ago who said, Rabbi, I did everything you told me. I put the, she had to take pills on Yom Kippur, and I put the detergent, and I wanted to make sure the detergent was well distributed, well dispersed through the water, so I shook it, and the foam of the soap all rose to the top, and it was the foam that made me want to throw up. It wasn't the problem drinking the water, it was the foam because I shook it. So tell them not to shake the water. After they put the detergent in. That's the end of the first year. Let's now move to the next year, to Rabbi Neuberger, who's going to talk about Hilchos Yom Tov. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Asher HaKol Nehiyah B'Dvaro. Okay, we were just Yossi, our Rebbe, this morning, Pim Parashah LaParashah, right there. Okay, so in Hilchos Yom Tov, we're going to start talking about gas stoves. The first thing we have to realize is that when it comes to lighting a fire, even though lighting a fire on Shabbos is aser midaraisa, lighting a fire on Yom Tov is only aser midrabbana. So once it's only aser midrabbana, there's going to be a little bit more leniency as far as when you're going to be able to ignite a fire in certain circumstances. Why is it to light a fire? That's machlokas rishonim, which we're not going to go into right now. Now, if you have the old stoves in the Heights, which I think there are fewer and fewer of, so they have a pilot light. If you have a pilot light, so that means the flame is always there. You're just adding gas, which extends the flame to go more places and reach out further. That's just being mamshit the flame, not being moly the flame, and that is mutal l'chatchila to raise. So if you have a pilot light oven, you have one of those old Washington Heights ovens, those are ideal for Yom Tov. You could just literally turn on the gas because the flame is already there. You just be mamshit. The eish that is permitted l'chatchila. The problem is that many states prohibit pilot lights, and they have an electric ignition, which is what most of all the newer ovens have. So electric ignition is going to be an issue because here you're igniting a fire, you're making a spark that is going to be aser, of course, midrabanan on Yom Tov. So therefore, you're not going to be able to turn on a flame on Yom Tov, and even if you have one of those coil stovetops, if you change, let's say it's on. So theoretically, you say, oh, I could raise a fire, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that you could raise the setting on the coils. Because the coils, let's say there's a 100, there's 200 degrees, 250 degrees, 300 degrees setting. It could be that each of the different settings on your coil, low, medium, and high, is not just adding more electricity or whatever it is to make it hotter. It might actually be using a new circuit. There's the 200 degree circuit. And then if you want to switch to medium, it goes, it turns it to 275. It's a different circuit. And the high, the 350, the 400 is a different circuit. So that could be, so therefore you, once you're dealing with a, once you're not, once you're out of the realm of a pilot light, you're in trouble. So what happens when it comes to lowering the flame? So lowering the flame is going to be equally usher as turning off a flame. The only time that you are allowed to lower a flame is the time that you're allowed to raise a flame. And that is in order to enable you to cook. So let's say you have a soup that if you leave it on the flame, it's going to burn. So you want, what do you do? You say, hey, let me just lower the flame because I'm lowering the flame for the cooking, right? Well, if you're worried that it's going to burn, just take it off the fire. Oh, if there's a very specific situation, which is far, few and far between, that you have to leave it on the fire, but if you leave it on the fire at this flame height, it's going to burn, that's the only time that you're really allowed to lower the flame. Again, otherwise take it off the fire. But if it has to be on the fire and it can't be high, so that's the only time you would be allowed to lower the flame l'chatchila on Shabbos. But even there, Shlomo Zalman says it's only if it's really going to burn or get really dried out. If it's just going to be a little, you know, a little not as juicy, that's not sufficient to warrant lowering the flame. So typically, you're not going to have too many situations where you're going to be able to lower the flame on Shabbos unless really it's really going to burn and you don't have the option of removing it from the flame. I'm talking about Yom Tov. Shabbos, you can't touch anything to do with fire.
I think what you just said,
Shabbos. Oh, thank you. Oh, this is, everything I just said is talking about Yom Tov. Thank you.
This would be for lowering the flame even on the electric?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Okay. Now, let's talk about Shabbos mode. So Shabbos mode that the Star K arranged with many manufacturers, including General Electric and others, has three features. Two are great, one is less great. Number one is that there's no 12-hour, even though legally many states have a 12-hour cutoff, if you have a Shabbos mode, it turns off the 12-hour cutoff, and if you have a two-day yontif, then 12-hour cutoff is really bad, because you're not going to be able to have food past the first meal. So number two is that it turns off any fans that might turn on or lights that might turn on if you open up the door of your oven. So that's also great. However, Rav Heinemann also engineered a possibility of, after he engineered that the screen turns off, the digital display turns off, Rav Heinemann suggested in this Shabbos mode that you could adjust, you could press the buttons on Yontif. Again, it's a faulty nomenclature. It's not really Shabbos mode, it's really Yontif mode, that you could press the buttons on the digital display. Again, there's no, the display is gone, the lights are not seen, but the pressing the buttons to raise or lower the temperature. So if it, let's say, you know, you set your oven to 300 when Yom Tov began, you press it five times up 10 degrees, each time you press it's now going to be 350, which is what you want. So Reb Heinemann suggested that if he engineered that when you press that button, there's a lag, you didn't really change anything. You put a situation in the brain of the, in the computer of the, in the brain of the oven, that when it cycles around, then it says, oh, I see that now I'm supposed to be 10 degrees higher. So after it finishes the cycling through, it realizes, oh, I'm supposed to go higher, then it will go higher. So there's a time delay, and it's, you know, it's a cycling through, it finds something is different now, I have to readjust myself. That's what the computer's thinking. So Rav Heinemann says that that would be okay to make the adjustments to the temperature up and down on Yom Tov. So most posts can reject that. And let me finish with Rav Heinemann's reason. Rav Heinemann says that by you having this time delay, that's grumma. You're only changing the changing the fire through grumma. And grumma on turning on a flame, which is an issur d'rabbanan on Yom Tov. So it's grumma on an issur d'rabbanan, and it's litzarech mitzvah, so that you could have your hot food that you want to have for your Yom Tov meal. So it's a grumma on an issur d'rabbanan, litzarech mitzvah, and therefore that's what Rav Heinemann wanted to have. The poskim all rejected the issur d'rabbanan of when you adjust the setting of a higher setting of an oven, you're making the flame go on. The way ovens work is it's not just a big flame and a little flame. The way ovens work is that there's a flame, and when it reaches the temperature, the flame turns off. There's a big flame in the oven. It's not like a little flame, big flame, hot, very big flame. There's a flame in the oven the same size. When you have a low flame, a low temperature, so the flame will be on just for 3 minutes, and that will stay there for a little while. If you have a higher temperature, you'll turn that flame on so that it could be ignite longer. So that's what happens when you raise the temperature in your oven. So all the poskim reject this leniency of Rav Heinemann by saying that this is not what grama means. Grama does not mean a time lag. Grama means that there's a koach acher me'urav bo. I do X, and something else. For example, grama is that I put a beach chair on the roof, near the edge of the roof, and a wind came and blew the beach chair off the roof and it killed somebody. That's grama. I harnessed some other power, like the wind, that wasn't here, that wasn't built into the situation. If I have a pre-built, pre-engineered unit called this Shabbos mode oven that is set to do exactly what I wanted to do with a little bit of a time lag, that does not constitute, say, the other poskim, a grama. And therefore, since there's no koach achar me'urav bo, a grama has to be, you do this, and you're waiting for some other thing to happen, some other, wind to blow, that will constitute grama. And therefore, they don't consider this grama, and therefore, the poskim reject this third aspect of the Shabbos mode kitchen, the Shabbos mode oven that Rav Heinemann suggested. Let's talk about it right now. What about just opening the door of an oven? So in terms of Shabbos, let's say like this. So in terms of Shabbos, Rabbi Neuberger is concerned that if you open the door, let's say you have an oven, what I do in my house Friday night is right before Shabbos, I turn the oven on a little bit high with all the food inside, get the oven hot, and I turn it off right before Shabbos, and there's no flame on. And I leave the food inside. The oven is well insulated, and the food will be warm and up piping hot. The food will be relatively hot if it was heated up Friday afternoon, and you turn it off right before candle lighting. It will stay hot an hour later when you come home from shul. Now, Rabbi Neuberger says, if you would leave the flame on in your oven, so let's say your oven is set for 300. So if you would leave the flame on at 300, the way it works is that it cycles on and off. Let's say the oven would right now be not burning. There would not be a fire right now because it's already at the temperature, the desired temperature of 300. When you open your door, what's going to happen on Shabbos? You're causing cold air to go in, and the cold air that's going to go in is going to generate the fire to the temperature. The thermometer will realize that it's colder, and it will make the flame go back on. And that would be grama, because here you're harnessing the air, cold air coming in. That would be grama. But it's grama on an Issur D'oraisa. That's on Shabbos. However, what would be on Yontif? On Yontif, when you open the door, let's say again, the flame is on, set for 300, and you open the door, what's going to happen? Cold air rushes in, and the flame is ignited on Yontif. But wait a second. We said that igniting a flame on Yontif is only an Issur D'rabbanan, not like Shabbos. So it's genuine grama, because here you do have the cold air coming in that's doing the gram. So you have a grama of an Issur D'rabbanan, and you're doing Letzorach Yontif. So therefore, it would be mutar lechatchila to open the oven on Yontif, to leave an oven lit before Yontif. And yes, to open up the pre-ignited oven on Yontif, because even if it will, turn the flame back on, that would be okay, because it's gram Issur D'rabbanan Letzorach Ochol Nefesh. However, when it comes to Shabbos, let's go back to Shabbos for a minute. You should just know that Rabbi Willig doesn't agree with Rabbi Neuberger. Rabbi Willig is of the opinion that if you have the flame on in your oven and you open the oven, it's not going to directly cause the oven to switch on right away. In the same way, says Rabbi Willig, when you open your door in the middle of the hot summer and you have AC on, or if you open your door in the middle of the winter and the wind, cold air gushes in and it's going to turn on your boiler, nobody's worried about that because it's not going to happen instantaneously enough. So therefore, Rabbi Willig holds you are allowed to open a lit oven on Shabbos. Rabbi Neuberger holds it's usur because he considers that will be directly causing the flame to go on. It's sort of almost like a machlokas and metzias, but that's all regarding Shabbos. And this is true, warming drawers is a whole separate issue. Rabbi Neuberger will ask their opening the door of a warming drawer equally. But on Yontif, you have what ends up being a sick ratio or a grama on an Issur D'rabbanan, so that will be okay.
Yeah, you can open the door, the oven on Yontif, even if you disagree with it behind you.
Correct. Because here you have real koch achar me'urav bo, you have the cold air coming in.
On Shabbos, if you have one of those ovens that you can hear that it's on, and you hear when it's on and hear when it's not on.
Yeah, if you have an oven that you could tell that the flame is on right now, then even Rabbi Willig would agree that you. Then even Rabbi Neuberg would agree. You could open the oven. Yeah. Let's go.
That noise, the little hum.
You have to know your oven. I don't want to. If your oven, if you know that your oven is ignited, is the flame is on right now, so then even Rabbi Willig would agree that you could open up that oven. Even Rabbi Neuberg would agree that you could open up that oven. Let's talk about a very common question, that is asking a guy to turn on an oven. So, of course, on Shabbos, you cannot ask a guy to turn on an oven because you're asking a guy to violate an Issa d'Oraisa. No heter for that, typically. However, if it's Yantif, so turning it on is only an Issa d'Rabbanan. Oh, so here you have a Amir L'Nachka, which is a Shavuos, to turn it on, which is on Yantif, which is also only a Shavuos, L'tzorach Mitzvah, to have a nice hot meal. But wait a second, what's the Tzorach Mitzvah? If you really want to have a hot, nice hot meal, why don't you just leave your oven on from before Yantif? Oh, you want to save a few bucks? That's not called a Tzorach Mitzvah. If you're doing it to save gas, we're not going to give you the leniency of Shavuos to Shavuos Makom Mitzvah to ask a guy to turn an oven on for Yantif for you. If, however, it's Shavuos, it's 90 degrees outside, and with the oven on inside the kitchen, it's really hot. So, or you have little kids, you don't want to leave an oven on for 2 days or 3 days with little kids around. Oh, then that kind of motivation is going to qualify as a tzorach mitzvah. Then you would be permitted to ask a guy to leave your oven up beforehand, and you'll ask a guy on Yantav to please turn on your oven. That would be a shuas to shuas makom mitzvah. But if your concern is just saving a few bucks or saving the environment, that would not qualify as being sufficient with tzorach mitzvah. Let's now finish. We've now finished the discussion about ovens. Let's now talk about Yontif Sheni in general. So the minhag since the Gaonim was to keep for Bnei Chutzar to keep 2 days. As Rabbi Schechter likes to point out, this seems to be the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch, because the Shulchan Aruch, when it speaks about following minhag makom shiyatza misham minhag makom shenimtzabo, the Shulchan Aruch paskins that we follow minhag makom shiyatza misham, and the sugya of Yom Tov Sheni is indeed a sugya of minhag. So it's minhag, and when it comes to minhag, like the Gemara says, "Zarb minhag avasech v'yadechem." So when it comes to minhag, we follow minhag makom shiyatza misham, and therefore, if you go to Eretz Yisrael, you should keep 2 days. Now, of course, there was the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi had a chiddush that he said that when do we say that you follow minhag makom shiyatza misham? That's not going to apply if there are kulas. So, for example, says the Chacham Tzvi, I'm worried that if you go to Eretz Yisrael, you want to follow your minhag keeping 2 days, but you're involved with making a bracha of Asher Kedusham Zitavis on Allah Kilas Matz on the second day of Yontif, when Eretz Yisrael there is no, you could call it, that maybe that's bracha levatala. Or maybe you're doing Bal Tosif. So, therefore, you're being nizhar b'minag makom shiyatza misham, that's only going to be if it's only to be machom, but if it's going to end up bringing these kulas that you're going to get yourself into hot water by following the minhag makom shiyatza misham like a bracha latal and baltosif, we wouldn't apply the din of minhag makom shiyatza misham. No one really accepted the Chacham Tzvi in Jewish history until like 40 years ago. Even his son, Yaivitz, what does Yaivitz stand for? Yaakov, Emdim, Ben? Tzvi, his father was the Chacham Tzvi. So even his son, the Yaivitz, disagreed with his father. Rabbi Yosher said you can't even be mitzari for the Chacham Tzvi as a Snif L'Hakel. Others are, you know, at least would consider Snif L'Hakel. But obviously, it's unfortunate that Balabatim sometimes consider, as Rabbi Neuberger points out, your position on Yom Tov Sheni as a barometer of how tzioni or open-minded you are, and to the extent that you don't accept what the minhag was in Klal Yisrael, that makes you not tzioni, and therefore, whatever. We won't go there now. But as I heard myself say when I was listening to my tape shir from last year, you have to figure out when you become a Rav if you want to work for Hashem, if you want to work for your Baal Batim. And that, you know, decision before you take your job and sign your first contract is an important concept to consider. Who's your employer? Is it Hashem or is it your Baal Batim? And that might inform many decisions that you make. The majority of the posts can do say that Bnei Chutzar should keep 2 days. Now, there is a kula of Rav Shlomo Zalman, and I actually had a balabas of mine ask me this shaila, and I told him the kula of Shlomo Zalman that if you're a Ben Eretz Yisrael, you could be a Ben Eretz Yisrael liyamim tovim. If you're there all 3 yom tovim, not just Pesach and Sukkot, but Shavuos also, so you're not a Ben Eretz Ben Chutzot. You're Ben Eretz Yisrael liyamim tovim. So I talk after he had that conversation with me. I was so impressed when I found out a few months later that he's going to Teretz Yisrael for Shavuos. Because that's really the, you know, that shows that he's really doing it. Only later I found out, his son said, oh yeah, my father went to Rav Asher Weiss, and Rav Asher Weiss told him that I thought he was listening to me, I was so proud of it, but I realized, you know, he didn't want to take my word after I told that, so I have to ask Rav Asher Weiss, but Rav Asher Weiss told him the same thing. So it worked out, you know, at least. Let's go to the next point. The next point, that was the Indian of Yom Tov Sheni. Let's now talk about showering. So there are a number of issues. What are the questions of showering on Yom Tov? So the questions could be that if you have, when you take out water from the shower head, cold water is coming through the pipes into your boiler and putting it into a pot of Kli Rishon, of boiling water, Al Ha'esh. That's called Bishul. Well, I didn't do Bishul. I just took water. I did a Psik Resha of causing the water to come in, the cold water to come into the boiler, so it's a Psik Resha Bishul. There's separately, and that's a concern to Araisa. Separate and apart from that, there's a Gzera Derabbanon, Gzeras HaBalonim, not to go to a Merchatz because we're worried that there are dishonest Balonim. Balonim meaning, now they use that word for mikvah lady, but Balonim are the bathhouse attendants, and we're worried that the Chachamim were worried, don't ever take a hot shower, a hot bath on Yom Tov, even with water that was heated up prior, before Shabbos Yom Tov, because we're worried that the dishonest bathhouse people might indeed be heating it up on Shabbos Yom Tov. So Rabbi Neuberger suggests a way to find a kula. If it's a 3-day Yom Tov and your mitzvah, so if we put together a bunch of scenarios, we could come out with a kula to allow a person who is mitzvah to shower on the Yom Tov Sheni, which would be the Rabbanan. And he puts together the following 5 tzirufim. Number one, if it's Yom Tov Sheni, is the Rabbanan. Number two, maybe if a person is mamish bitzar, not just that they like showering, but then bitzar if they don't shower, that could elevate the need to shower to be considered ochel nefesh. Number three, the gzeres habalonim, there are some opinions who say that it's only in a bath, not a shower. Number four, there's a machlokas if gzeres habalonim is limited only to hot water, even to warm water. Maybe warm water doesn't have the gzeres habalonim. And number five, there's a machlokas whether or not gzeres habalonim applies to Yom Tov or only to Shabbos. And therefore, if you put all these things together, you take not a bath, but a shower, and not in hot water, but lukewarm water, and it's on Yom Tov, and it's Yom Tov Sheni, and your mamish bitzar, that he'll grant you, Rabbi Neuberger will say, you could shower in that lukewarm shower on Yom Tov Sheni if you're mitzvah. That's the end of that sugya. Okay? Let's go to the next year. What are we being matzah of tzorach mitzvah?
No, meaning it's not. Meaning you're sharing with tzorach, you're covered.
It's hard to say that it's covered yom tov to shower when Chazal said you're not allowed to shower. It's like the person who says, I want to clean my shirt because it's covered Shabbos. No, it's kula Shabbos. No, it's only, let's say it's only kibbutz d'rabbanan. So, you know, okay. Yeah.
Well, what's
the fourth
reason?
Gzeres Balonim. Gzeres Balonim might only apply to baths, but not showers. Gzeres Balonim might only apply to hot water, not lukewarm water. And Gzeres Balonim might only apply on Shabbos, not Yom Tov. Plus Mitztar, plus Yom Tov Sheni, Drabbanos. Those are the five. Let's now talk about... You want to do Sukkah or Dal Minim? That was unanimous. Okay, let's talk about Dalad Minim. So Rabbi Kunigsberg's shiur about Dalad Minim. So the first point that we have to realize is that a Esrog has to be an Esrog, and therefore it can't be a Murkav. What's the problem with a Murkav? So the Levush says that a Murkav is a Misababa Aver. You're not allowed to be Markiv Ilonos. That's Kilei HaIlon. And the Levush. The Magen Avraham says, no, an Esrog has to be an Esrog. If it's Murkav, it's not an Esrog. There's this wild opinion of the, I don't know how Rabbi Kunigsberg kind of found it, Saba Kadish Alefandi, who says any citrus fruit, even a lemon, is kosher, but I don't know how he found that. Okay, so we have a question of figuring out what is considered a murkav or not, so the Ramah gives us some simonim to ensure that it's an estrog. It has to have blitos, bumps, and the ukats is shakua, the inside of that bottom thing is shakua, shakua. Indented, thank you. The klipa is thick, the seeds are vertical as opposed to horizontal. So that's the 4 simanim of the Ramah. And the badatz, when it says that this Paradis is under the Badats, that means that they took some lemons, some estrogen from this Paradis, they cut it in half, and they looked and found these four simanim. They said, okay, it follows the Mitzvah four simanim. So that's one of the situations when the Badats is not a good Hechsher. That's not the greatest, you know, that's not the greatest, that's, you know, the lowest standard of defining an Esther. The Chasam Sofer says, it's not really good just to rely on Simonim, like the Badat says, but you should have a Masores, or know the Paradis, and that would be, you know, the more expensive ones. So, but that's Esrogan without anything additional, usually the cheapest. Okay, let's talk about some of the Psulim of Dalin Minim. So number one, the Mishnah Sukkah says, Nitla Pitmaso is Pasal. The question is, what is the Pitam? So we have another, we have Nitla Shashanta, that's Kasher. So the Shashanta, the ball, the Pitam is, let's say, the stick that comes up. We'll talk about it more in depth in a moment. And the Shashanta is that ball on top of the stick, right? The lollipop on top of the, you know, the candy on top of the stick. So if the ball on top falls off, that's Kasher, according to Moshe Shonim. If the stick itself falls off, so then that's going to be a subject to Machlokas. Taz says that it has to be, so much has to fall off that there is left an indentation on the head of the Esther. There's an indentation because the whole thing came out. Other Machmer, even if part of the, even if only part of the stick fell off, and others say that it has to be the entire stick has to fall off, but there need not be an indentation in order to passel it. Rabosai, this happened to me this past Sukkos. I bought a few Esrogim, one for me, one for my son, one for my other son, one for my other son, and one of my sons happened to not even be my katan, who happened to be my bar mitzvah boy. I was just focusing on looking at the skin of the Esrog, and I just totally ignored the fact that it was half of the stem was broken off. My son, my bar mitzvah boy, took it, and he said, the first second he saw it, he said, like, I'm the rabbi, and he's the, you know, the 13-year-old bar mitzvah boy, he just started putting on tefillin, and he says, Abba, the pitam fell off. I'm like, don't worry, according to contemporary halacha, it's still kosher. So he didn't really buy that. But Lamaisa, the seller, had already closed by the time we got to him the next day. He had already closed shop. So I told my son, you could use it, as we'll say right now. So the Mishnah Berurah says that even if the shashanta, the top ball falls off, if it's mehudar, it's better to take, which was the case in my situation, even if the shashanta falls off, it's better to take that than to take something less pretty that has the shashanka. But if a piece of the stem falls off, then you have to avoid it, even if it would be mehudar. But even if it would fall off so much so that l'chol hadeis is considered nitla pitmas, the entire thing fell off, there's mamash a hole and an indentation on the head, still, it's only going to be possible on the first day when you need a l'kichatama, l'kachtem, l'chem b'yom rishon, but the psul of chaser, because the psul of chaser is only on the first day, but not on the further days. Now, this issue of first day versus other days, we just mentioned the distinction by chaser. There's another psul that applies to Dalin Minim, and that's the psul of hadar. Hadar, does that apply only on the first day or all 7 days? That's a machlokas. So, Tosa says that hadar is possible all 7 days, and the Rambam, you can look if you can look in your notes why Tosa says that, but the Rambam argues and says that psul, just like the psul of chaser only applies on the first day, so too the psul of hadar also applies on the first day. The Shulchan Aruch Takas make like the Rambam that the psul of just like chaser, so too hadar also only applies on the first day. The problem is the Rambam is machmir like Tosa that hadar is psul all 7 days. So based on this, we could have a case of the following. What is the What do we consider the case of Nitla Pitmaso? Nitla Pitmaso, some say it's a psul of hadar, some say it's a psul of chaser. So can you use an ester that's Nitla Pitmaso on the latter days of Sukkah? So the Mishnah Berurah says I have a svek sveka. If it's chaser, if the problem of the psul of Nitla Pitmaso is chaser is only a problem on the first day, not the second, next rest of the days. Oh, and if it's a problem of hadar, well, there's even Shitas HaRambam who's Mekel and says even the psul of Hadar only applies on the first day, not the rest of the 7 days. So I have a sekseka. Maybe it's the psul itself is a psul chaser, which is only on the first day. And even if you hold that it's a psul of Hadar, well, there's still somebody within the sugi of Hadar who holds that Hadar applies only on the first day. And you have a sekseka, so you could be Mekel on Nitla Pitmaso, even if the entire stem falls off for the second through seventh day of Sukkot. Any questions about that? Somebody's hand was up? No. Vayter. Next point. Let's talk about a shinui mara, a discoloration on the body of the esrog. So, the Gemara tells us that a chazazis, some kind of discoloration, a blister, a pimple, miuto kosher, rubo pasul. However, if you have even a mute, even one little blister, one little discoloration blister, in numerous places, then it's not just a problem of nishtana hamara, it's a considered menumer, it's considered spotted, like a namer, which is a leopard, and that will be a psil of hadar. The Rishonim say that's not only by blisters, it even applies to black and white dots, and the Rush says that this psil of, there are lots of dots, if you find these two or three dots, it's going to be puzzle, not that there just happen to be two or three dots, but if there are two or three dots, you would connect those dots, and that connect, make you that triangle, or that square of the number of dots, would cover the majority of the area, the majority of the circumference of the esrog, then it would be a problem. If you just had two or three dots right next to each other, very close by one to another, in close proximity, that would not be a problem. Now, that's all on the body of the esrog. However, b'chotem afil b'mashu pasul. If you have a chazazis, a discoloration on the chotem, then even a tiny bit is possible. What's the chotem? So we have a machlokas. What the chotem is, a chotem could be only the very base of the pit. Maybe it's just the base of the pitem. The Rashi says it's where the actual line, the demarcation of the fat part of the esrog to where it starts to slope upward, that line itself is called the chotem, and the Rush, whom we follow, says that any part, which is the most chamidic opinion, is what I'm about to say now, is that any part of the upward slope of the esrog is all called the chotem. That whole area, if you're holding an esrog and looking at it, you know, top down, bird's eye view, that whole area that you see, that upward slope, that's all called the chotem, and therefore even a mashu, a chazazis on that area, will be considered pasul. That will be chotem, afil mashu. But the Magen Avraham says it's only if it's taka noticeable by the eye. If you have a bletzel, a scab that was from a thorn that grew over it, the Maharil says that it's not a mara esrog, it's going to be a problem. Same parameters as chazaz, as we just learned, but we don't paskin like that. We basically go like the Trumas Hadash, and that it is considered a mara esrog, and therefore it's going to be okay even if it's on the chotem. Fine. Let's talk about green esrogim. The Gemara says that if it's yari kakarti, like leek, it's pasul. Why? So there's a machlokas why a yarok kakarti is possible. Maybe because it's a shinimara. Well, if it's a shinimara, then it depends on how much green there is. The Magen Avraham says, no, it's nothing to do with shinimara, how it looks. It's because it's not nigmar hapri. But, says the Magen Avraham, if the whole vort is that it's not nigmar hapri, if you know that the pri, right now it's green, but you know that it's once it was taken off the tree, it's green now, but you know that it will be able to just yellow as it just ripens off the tree already, so it is nigmar hapri. Once you took it off the tree, when it was nigmar hapri, you would be able to use it even while it is still green. You don't have to actually wait for it to ripen, as long as you know that it will ultimately ripen. Mishabura says that even according to Magen Avraham, you should still wait for it to turn a little bit yellow. Let's talk about a lulav now. Nechlaka tiyomes is pasul. What's nechlaka tiyomes? Fundamental machlokas rishonim. Riff and Ramam hold that every leaf is called a tiyomes, and if the majority of the leaves in your lulav are split, that's pasul. However, the Rush, like the Ashkenazim follow, say no, we look at the tiyomes only as the middle leaf only, and therefore there's a big chumrah. If that middle leaf is split, you have to be worried. So Ashkenazim are much more machmir. They say, according to Sfaradim, you could have, you know, a third of the leaves of the tops of the tips are split and still kosher, but according to the Rama, we're machmir that as long as that middle one, if that middle one is split, you're already in trouble. How much split? So Rav Rishon say, if the rove of the leaf from the shedra, top of the shedra till the tippy top, that's going to be pasul. But the Ran says that there are those who are machmir, even b'nechaka b'miyuta, which is what all the B'nai Torah, you know, try and strive to get, that it should be even, that even b'miyuto, it's not nechlak, but mamash even a mashu. But the grass says you don't have to be worried about a mamash a mashu, but that's where, you know, that's where the expense of lulavim come in, you know, the $20, $40, $50, $70 lulavim, I mean, it's all because of getting that mashu on top. Kara is the brown stuff that sometimes it's good because it keeps everything together. On the other hand, you don't know if it's split underneath, so it might not be as good. Kafuf, if you have the Shulchan Aruch says that kafuf is pasul, but there's a machlokas if only the shedra is kafuf, or even if kafuf would apply even to the leaves. A knepel is when the very, very top is bent. It's not the whole thing is bent over, but it's just a little knepel, just the very tippy top is bent, and that Rosh says is okay. And he says sometimes it's even better that way because you know that the two tips of the tiyomis are together when they're bent over together. But the Ran is machmir. He says no, knepel, that little bend on top is a pasul, so it's better to. So what's a hinder for the Rosh is actually a psul for the Ran. Let's jump to Hadassim now. And Hadassim should be Mishulashim. They should be, like the Pasuk says, Anafei Tzavos, Tzavos means braidus, you have to have three or more. So there's a machlokas of how Mishulash they have to be. So Rashi has a Chumran says that the three, at any given point, the three leaves on any given point on the level of the Hadass have to be coming out of the same exact height of the stem. Tosis and the Rosh are making, they say, no, as long as those three are smuch medvukim, and if you draw, the Chazon says, if you draw a line around the stem, and it would hit part of the base of each of those three leaves, even if the leaves are not coming out at the same exact point, that also is sufficient. We typically are making like this latter opinion, and you don't need that the three come out of the same exact point on the stem. Okay, let's go to the next year. The next year we'll do is either feminism or Hilchas Sukkah. Sukkah. Okay. So let's do feminism, if you don't mind. We'll do feminism. So, in feminism, women's issues in feminism, so Rabbi Reis spoke about the starting off with the sugya of Kol Melamed Es Bito Torah Kilu Melamed Tiflus. So, the Prisha points out that that's referring to Rov Nashim, but if there's an individual woman who herself demonstrates a thirst for Torah and she's responsible in its learning and she's not in the Rov, she's Parish Min HaRov, so such a woman you could. That's one point. Second point, as far as women learning is, of course, halacha that applies to them. They do have to learn. So let's look at Shulchan Aruch. Yoredeya, yep, that applies to them. Ebenezer, yep, much of that applies to them. Choshen Mishpat, yep, all of that applies to them. What did I skip? Or Chaim, yep, that applies to them. So basically, Da'af Elke Shulchan Aruch all applies to us. There's plenty for women to learn, even if they feel like, oh, we don't have it, you don't let us learn. Well, they can learn basically the vast majority of Dalchag and Shulchan Aruch. Of course, we know that Rav Soloveitchik said that a woman nowadays in our generation, in order to appreciate the sophistication, I don't know if he uses these words, but the way we understand is that in order to appreciate the sophistication and Chashivas HaTorah, she has to see the sophistication in her Libudei Kodesh no less than, you know, her getting a PhD in astrophysics from MIT. Why should she think that Torah is, you know, kindergarten stuff and everything else in the world is complicated and sophisticated? So in our generation, Rav Soloveitchik felt women should learn on the same way that men learn, the same level. It's important to keep in mind as you go out into the world that other than Rav Soloveitchik, no one really among the Gedolim really went with that extent. So when you go out in the world and you encounter other Rabbanim and they hear that you have a Gemara, you should just be ready, that's open to women, just be ready to be aware that it will be a Chiddush for other Rabbanim who learned in other yeshivas. It's just important to be aware of the a broader perspective of the Masorah. We have our Masorah, but other Rabbanim have other Masorahs from their yeshivas. In general, when we talk about, let's talk about leadership roles for women. In general, there are a number of areas that you have to be concerned with. First of all, there's a sugya of Asrara, which we'll talk about in a moment. There's the questions of tznius, which is not just a musar machshava, but it's actually paskin halacha lemaisa as being the source why Amoni v'lo Amonis, Moavi v'lo Moavis, because only men go out to war, and women, only men go out to greet people, not women, because kol kvoda basmel pnimus, that's a halachic nafkamina of tznius, it's not just a, you know, a musar shmuz. Of course, another area that has to be evaluated with women's leadership positions is the Mesorah in general. And of course, certain areas of halacha, like if there's a gzeiras hakaz, that a woman can't be a dayan or be an aide or participate in a minyan, that's not deraisa, but there's no wiggle room. Halacha is halacha. So let's discuss tzrara. The pasuk in the Torah says, Som tasim alacha melech. The Sifri comments on that, and we paskin, melech v'lo malka. That means that the highest position of authority is not allowed to be held by a woman. The Rambam, however, has a different version of that Sifri. It says, V'chein kol mesimos shevi Yisrael. All other positions of authority. Which brings us to the famous tshuva of Ramosha about mashkichot. Could a woman be a mashkicha? So Ramosha points out that Merov Rishonim do not hold like this chumra of the Rambam of V'chein kol mesimos shevi Yisrael. And therefore, most Rishonim would probably hold that only a Malka is off-limits, only the highest level of authority, but other positions of authority in Klal Yisrael, certainly like a Mashkiach, wouldn't be considered a problem. However, if a Rambam says something, we're not going to ignore the Rambam. So yes, v'shas hadchak, we might be able to rely mikra din on the other Shitas, but under normal ideal situations, we of course would be machmir for the Rambam, and indeed, because of our being choshev for the Rambam, as we are always machmir for, we should, under normal circumstances, not allow a woman to take leadership positions, even as a mashkiach. However, in a case that's a great shas hadchak, like the specific shaila he was asked, where the woman was an almana, she didn't have a parnasa, and he said also, if she would work under the authority of a senior rav, who would be the official mashkiach, or the official rav hamashkiach, then there might be room to be mekel, because mi'ikar hadin, we paskin that srara is not apply to Kol Mesimos Shevi Yisrael, because we don't pass like that Rambam. But we should try to. Speak to your local Orthodox Gadol. Rav Salvezhik added that aside from the sugya of Strara, there's a separate sugya called Minui, which, even if it's not necessarily Strara, Minui is an appointing to a position. With this, Rav Salvezhik wanted to explain why. All of a sudden, the Ramah points out that women, even though women previously in history are kosher for Ashkita, but Ramah says nowadays women shouldn't be shochter. Why not? So Salvezhik suggested that in olden days women just shechted in their backyards, but once it became an official position in a community, that would be a minui, and it would be included in the isser of in the general issue of Kol Mesimos Shevi Yisrael, even though it's not an authority position, but it's an appointed position. Once it's appointed, that makes it into like a Kol Mesimos Shevi Yisrael. And for example, a ger, who we know is not allowed to have a position of strara, can have a position of a minui. So even if we would say that a ger cannot be a shul president because it's strara, but a ger would be able to be a shochet because the minui itself wouldn't be considered Sarah. Mini would be okay for a ger, Sarah not, but a woman, Rasalvesh suggests, has not only the issue of Sarah, but also holding a position. So you have this issue when it comes to women on the as a president, vice president. Somebody asked me, in my shul, could women be on my board? I asked Rav Shachter, he said, if it's one member of a board, that would probably be okay, but again, each shul will have to be, discuss it with another gadol on their own, depending on the situation. Yes.
What is the difference between
Minui
and Strara?
Strara is an authority position. Minui is not necessarily this is an authoritative position, but it's an appointed position. It's something that we rely on this person. So if you have the official person who does this is the official person in the community who's responsible for this. It might not be an authority position. But since they're the appointed person in the community regarding this, like if I'm just giving a terrible example. I have a class and I say, you're my official, you tell me exactly what time class starts and class finishes. You, my fourth grade student, you tell me what time it's, 8 o'clock in the morning, what time I finish class at 10:30 in the morning. You're the official timekeeper of the class. That's a minui. Not authority. What?
Why can't?
The Salvation says the very fact that it's a minoy makes it have a din of tzara.
But not for gay, even though
correct.
So applies.
Yes, correct. That's right. Let's move on. So let's go now, what about women rabbis? So you have to obviously deal with the question of tzara. But even without the question of tzara, let's talk about a different point. The Rambam writes that smicha doros is not just, you know, it's not like it used to be of putting your hands on your head on the Talmud's head. Rather, you call him rabbi, says the Rambam, and he has rishus ladan dine knasos. So according to the Rambam, what does smicha mean? Smicha by definition means rishus ladan dine knasos, and we know that midaraisa a woman is psula ladun. So therefore, by definition, smicha should be off limits, since Dionysus is off limits to a woman. Theoretically, according to this reading of the Rambam, smicha to a woman should also be equally off limits. That would be a very halachic reason why a woman shouldn't be able to be a rabba, whatever funny name you might want to give that title, but that position should be off limits because they're psulim ladali din iksos. What about women just pasking in general, or you could call them yotzot, or no, in a position of being able to pasken? So the Tosfos points out that Dvora taught, and furthermore, there's a Sefer Chinuch who says that the psul of shtuye yayin, not to drink wine before pasking, applies to a woman, because a woman is ksheru lahora, it sounds like a woman could pasken. So according to Soloveitchik, even if there's no srara, there might still be an appointed position of paskening, might be a psul of minui. According to the Tshuva of Ramosh that we saw earlier, even if a woman would have some authority, she should still work under the supervision of the Rav, so you don't have the other issue of srara. But when you look at the sugya of Dvora, who presumably paskin, Tosis points out that she might not have paskin herself, but she taught the men how to paskin. So in other words, she might have, you know, been a maramakum, say, why don't you look at this, what about this, maybe you should think of life like this, but maybe she didn't do the psak herself, and accordingly, the application to a case of a, you know, in a community where a woman might be in that situation, if she is under the authority and the jurisdiction of the Rav Ha'ir, and she only teaches as opposed to paskins, that might ameliorate the issue a little bit. Bottom line, any shul that would consider going with the Yoetz, it should certainly, based on that shul's population, the community that it serves, discuss that with an Adam Gadol, who is one of the, you know, somebody who is responsible to the one of the Baalei HaMesorah, to see how that would fit in, their shul would fit in with Mesorah Klal Yisrael. Especially important to keep in mind, and this applies also to women getting aliyahs and women laning, which is a different sugya, laning and laning Megillah, which is a different sugya. But the Bach writes that kavod hatzibur doesn't mean that a given tzibur could say, if we define our tzibur as women friendly or women or egalitarian, it doesn't mean that our tzibur is okay with this stuff. To the contrary, says the Bach, kavod hatzibur is not relative to each individual tzibur, what we define as kavod. There are certain objective parameters of what is defined as kavod hatzibur, and that is not waivable by a given community that might be okay with certain deviations from classical Mesorah. Let's talk about Kaddish, women saying Kaddish. So the Chavetz Yara suggests that there probably is a tikkun to the neshama if a daughter would say Kaddish. However, the Chavetz Yara says, but I don't think it's a good idea because it's going to weaken the Koach HaMenhagim, and this is something that's a mefursim, it's proper not to do it. Rav Hengen argued and said that if they are tahorim and snuim and they're wearing appropriate clothing, and he said, Efsher Shein Kfeida, maybe it's okay, but not in the base Knesses and not Bilvush America. So, whatever you think Bilvush America means if she's just Tznias, and she's not in the Shul Mamish, Roshethu says the opposite. Roshethu says, no, it's only Mutter. You can't say Dorim Shabakdush if there are no 10 men. So if she's in the women's section, how can she see a Kaddish? There's no minion. So you have to bring her into the men's section. Oh, if your Shul is going to allow women in the men's section, that's going to be, you know, even the people who are okay with women saying Kaddish, but they might not be okay with her doing it in the men's section. That's going to open up a whole other bag of worms. So it's just another thing to consider. I saw Rav Moshe, this was not mentioned in the Shia, but I saw Rav Moshe the Tshuva, where he talks about when do you need a mechitza, if it's just like, if it's not a real shul, it's just like, let's say, a class revel, and you happen to have 10 guys there and 2 girls. You want to daven marav right after class. Do you need a mechitza? Do you not need a mechitza? So Rav Moshe, in that Tshuva, happens to say, and we know that the minhag of Klal Yisrael has always been that women would say Kaddish, and then he says, there's a lot to write about that, but that's not what I'm talking about. But he does say that there is a minhag in Klal Yisrael that women do say Kaddish, but he doesn't say it's that good or bad, he just says, I have what to say about it. But he just points out that women do come into shuls to collect tzedakah and to say Kaddish. So, again, he's not saying that that's right, he's just saying that there are, that that has been done. Others argue and say that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says, if Medina is mutter, so you shouldn't stop them, because if something's mutter Medina and you stop them from saying Kaddish, you're feeding the argument that's saying that we're oppressive. It's mutter and you're still saying not to. But others say, no, there's a slippery slope. Once you allow this, it's going to allow that, which is certainly a concern. And again, each, if you have it halacha ma'is and shuls under certain circumstances, this comes up most often actually at burials. When you have a burial in certain communities where there's a daughter, certainly if it's an only daughter or if it's a daughter with her brothers, sometimes as the sons will say Kaddish, the daughter will want to join along. So figure out when you become a Rav and these shadows will come up, you'll ask your local Orthodox Gadol how you should operate. Let's finish off this year with a bas mitzvah question. So Moshe says, we're already unhappy with how the bar mitzvahs are going. Why should we start, you know, having gala bat mitzvahs? But the Sri Deish says, to the contrary, if you want to be mechanic and inspire a woman to be more committed in her achrayis and achiv and mitzvahs, so you can't do it in the shul, but you could have, and it's not going to be a break in the Masorah, it's near, so even though you can't do it in the shul, but it's okay to have such thing in a social hall. Svaradim, on the other hand, Ravadi says, to the contrary, the Ben Ish Chai did make a bas mitzvah, as long as it's roi lomash zirus mios with teshlachos on her reaching an ol mitzvos. Rabbi Willick has a very lamdisha chiluk that he likes to say when he talks about a bas mitzvah. He says that there are two dinim in a bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah, one is that the father finished teaching his son Torah, and all the second aspect of a bar mitzvah is that the child, the son, has reached ol mitzvah. So Willick is mechalik that when it comes to a bas mitzvah, so the father never had the real fear of teaching his daughter Talmud Torah. So the father has no reason to celebrate. So the father shouldn't be inviting his friends. But the girl, on her level, did reach ol mitzvah, so she could invite her friends. So if you ask Rabbi Willick, you have a make a bas mitzvah, he tells you this very original and very unusual distinction that the parents can't invite their friends, but the daughter can invite her friends, based on this lamdas that we just put forth. Sorry? Of course there's no chiv of Talmud Torah and daughters. It's a pasuk and a chiv. Of course, one condition. Women are not mechuyavos in Talmud Torah. I'm not saying you're allowed to let your daughter, of course you have to teach your daughter, but the woman is not chayavos in Talmud Torah. Is there a chiv of chinach? That's a different question. But Talmud Torah, certainly not. And the pasuk discussed, it's machlokes rishonim, that maybe even the mitzvah of chinach, all the halachas of not telling a child to be mechal Shabbos, because if you give a chinach, does that apply to girls or only to boys? That's my focus, Yishanah. But certainly Talmud Torah, women are not mechiyavos in Talmud Torah. Okay, let's talk about Rabbi Sobolevsky's shir about caring for children on Shabbos. So let's start with nursing. Pumping, a woman who uses an automatic pump or a hand pump would be an Issa Daraisa of Disha. Just like milking a cow is Disha. The problem is that if you could help the baby by giving the baby formula. So the baby is happy, the baby is fed, but the mother could be in a lot of pain because she has a lot of milk, and let's say the baby isn't consuming all that milk, so she's left with a lot of milk that could be very painful to a woman. So how can we alleviate her pain if we don't have the option of pumping the excess milk out? So the suggestion would be to knock down this disha d'oraisa to be only an issa d'rabbanan. How can we do that? Because once it's d'rabbanan, we could say that it's a drabana b'makon tsar. So the answer would be by being cholev li'ibud, by letting the milk go li'ibud. So here we have machlokas. Why would that be better? So one possibility would be because that would make it a malacha she'ena tzrich le'gufa, because you're not using the milk, you're just being dashed to get rid of the milk. And that would be one reason. Another suggests that since it's not letzorech, by disha specifically, if it's something is not letzorech, it's not considered a malacha at all. Disha is different than other things. It's not just in a letzrich legufa, which knocked down to the bottom, but it's not called a malacha if it's by disha if it's not being used. Nafkamina that Chazanish points out is that when do you have to get rid of it? Could you put it into a could the pump go into the regular jar that collects it and then pour it into down the drain? Or as it's coming out mamish, you have to make it go libo. Like you have to let it go straight from the pumper into not a jar but straight down the drain, or there has to be detergent on the bottom of the pumper jar so that as it's pumped, it's going directly into detergent. If you assume that it's a melacha shenein tzrich legufa, that you're not going to use it, so it doesn't have to get be gotten rid of right away. You're not going to use it, so it's knocked out from being a doraisa. If you hold that it's not a melacha at all because it's not. But if you hold it's not a malacha at all, it's only going to be not a malacha if it goes immediately li'ibud. So if a woman is in a lot of pain, we would say that you could pump using an electric pump on a Shabbos clock, or a guy could turn on the pump if it's an electric pump. If there's no guy, there's no clock. As a last resort, maybe you'd be able to use a kala'achar yad to turn the pump on with your elbow or something, electric pump on with your elbow. That would only be in a sidra banan. As long as the liquid, the milk will not be saved, and you should try to let the milk be lost immediately by putting some detergent on the bottom of the jar of the pump. Let's talk about making baby cereal, or oatmeal, rice cereal. So here the problem would be one of lisha. So how could we, lisha is taking flour and liquid, putting it together to make a batter of sorts. So how could we make it mutter? So we have machlokes tanoim, and rishonim, and in the Shulchan Aruch, what is the moment of Isser that constitutes Lisha? Is it the Nesinas Hamayim? Or is the Shas Gibel, the mixing, the kneading with a K, is that the Shas Isser? So if we are able to make a Shinui in whichever one is the right one, that could be a solution. So I'll make a Shinui in Nesinas Hamayim. I'll put it, do it in the wrong order. I'll put in the water first, then I'll put in the mix. And I'll also mix it in a funny, funny way. So I made a Shinui in both of the possibilities. Okay, but if you do a shinui, then that just should knock it down to be the rabbanon. It happens to be, for some reason, when it comes to lisha, a shinui kla'achayad in lisha becomes mutter entirely. So we're going to do the shinuyim in the way we, the direction in which, the order in which we put in the water and the mix. And I'll do a shinui my gibel, I'll do a shesi of erev. Instead of mixing around, I'll do kris and an X, like a T or an X. And also I'll do my finger instead of a spoon, and also I'll maybe lift out my finger each time. I'll do all kinds of shinuyim. But that's only... But some poskim say that this kula of using the shinui is not by lisha d'orais, but only by lisha d'rabbanan. So therefore, I have to knock down this oatmeal to be from lisha d'orais to the lisha d'rabbanan. How can I do that? By turning the mixture into a belila raka, into a loose, watery, diluted batter, more like a pancake batter as opposed to a challah dough, and then it would only be such a mixture only be nesinas rabbanon, and you can be making if you make these shinuyim in both the nesinas hamayim as well as the kibul. But again, this kula is only to provide food for a baby who needs it, not something that you could do to make yourself oatmeal on Shabbos afternoon. Let's talk about another point for children, food for children. That is tochein, cutting vegetables or chicken small for the baby. So number one, tochein, the issur of tochein, only applies to tvarsha, gidula, and hakar, because therefore chicken, eggs, is not subject to tochein. You can mash it, chop it however you like. However, anything that is gidula, and hakar, like vegetables, are going to be subject to tochein, and therefore you can't cut them too small. How small is small? Says the Yireim, says Rabbi Elazar Mimetz, the Yireim, quoted by the Shmuel, we don't know how small is small. So what are we going to do? So there is a sheet of the Rashba who has a very wonderful kula. The Rashba suggests that just like when it comes to borer, there's a heter called miyad, immediately before the seudah you can do borer. So too, says the Rashba, that heter of miyad will apply to tochein as well. And therefore, if you do it immediately before the seudah, whatever amount of time you need for getting ready for the seudah, it could be for 20 minutes, it could be for 2 hours, depending on how many people you have, how fancy you are, how much effort you like in making your seudah. It depends on you. If you have a caterer, preparation for a seudah could be 3 or 4 hours before a seudah. In that time period, says Rashba, that's going to be miyad, and it will be mutter to cut it small. Now, we are more machmir. We say we're not sure if we could be making like this Rashba. We say we're also going to be make certain that they're not too small. So if you have a combination of pieces that are not cut too small, you don't have a good definition of that, and also it's done within the immediate proximity of the meal, that would be okay. But if you want to, for example, cut up a salad, and then your wife wants to go to shul, she'll cut up the salad, go to shul for musaf, and then come home and eat, that's not okay, because that's not considered miyad. She went to shul in the middle. So that would not be okay. Let's talk about the next aspect of tochen, and that would be shmushed bananas or shmushed avocado. So, says the Chazon Ish, this is an issa daraisa of tochen, and it's even worse than regular chopping vegetables, and it's considered, and therefore, because it's a more of a shmushing, these bananas are is such a shmushing, more than just dicing, it's going to be usher, even summer, even you won't even have the kul of the Rashba of Samach L'Sa'uda, of La'alt, you won't even have that, because it's super tochen. Comes from Moshe and Feist and says, I don't understand. Not only should this not be super tochen, this should not be tochen whatsoever. What is tochen? Tochen is taking a wheat kernel and chopping it into particles. What happens when you take a banana and you mush it? You're not making it into particles. Avocado mush. It's not going into particles. It's not tochen at all. However, says Ramosha, so according to me, says Ramosha, you could shmush bananas l'chatchil and avocados l'chatchil. Oh, but the Chazon Ish says, Nisadorai said, don't do it. However, the Chazon Ish said that if you do it, k'l'achayat, with the back of a spoon, with the handle of a knife, then it would be mutter. So even though I don't understand, says Ramosha, why that should be, why that hetah should make a mutter l'chatchila, should just knock it down to be derabanan. But since the Chazon Ish said you're allowed to do it, and I don't hold that the Chazon Ish is a problem at all, but to be, well, you, I'll allow you at least to take the kula of the Chazon Ish, and therefore Ramosha is would allow if we would shmush our banana or our avocado with the back of a the handle of a knife, the handle of a spoon. Next, Nakuda, let's talk about diaper changing. As far as baby wipes, there are two issues. There's baby wipes and there's the diaper. Baby wipes is machlokas if, in our yeshiva, Shechter Willig, if you're allowed to, if using a baby wipes is considered squeezing the liquid out or is considered there's just liquid on the outside of it that you're just letting the liquid apply, you know, you're not squeezing anything out. So could you use baby wipes? That's a question. As far as diapers, there are two issues, and that's Korea. And it's sister halacha of tofer. When you open up the tabs, the adhesive tabs, so the Rambam had told it, teaches us that when it comes to tofer, just like there's tofer, classic tofer, also be medabik niyoros is tofer, and be mafrid niyoros is korea. So if you have Velcro, Velcro is just hook and eyes. They're not really adhesions. So that's okay. But if you have the brands that are actually sticky, so that could be a question. Are you, when you open up the tab, you're being korea. When you put the baby together, that's tofer. When you, if you have a really dirty diaper and you want to throw it out, oftentimes you close it up so it doesn't drip all over the place. That's going to be tofer, and that's going to be more of a problem because that's going to be tofer in a way that's going to be kayim, because it's going to stay like that in the garbage forevermore. So here, the question would be, could we say that maybe kosher, tofer, just like we say that kosher shel eina shel kayam is more kalsu, could we say the same thing applies by the malach of tofer? That if it's Enoshel Kayama, so if I put the tabs on the baby's body, I'm tofer the tabs together, but it's just for the next 4, 5, 6 hours, as long as the baby will be wearing this diaper. So the Rama leaves it as a question. He's a little bit, you know, not thrilled with that. But when we throw it out, it really could be a question of tofer shel kayama. Some say that no, once you're throwing it out, you don't really care about it. So how can you call that tofer shel kayama if it's something that you don't really care about at all? So that's a svara you could take or leave. So halacha lemaisa, oh, and what about when you open up the tabs? Some say when you open up the tabs, that might not be considered korea because it was made to be opened, even though you are opening it for the first time. So therefore, certainly what you should do, halacha lemaisa, so if you want to, if you get Velcro, perfect, no worries. If you have the adhesion, the adhering ones, and you want to open them before Shabbos, you're wonderfully frum, and we will respect you for that. But certainly what everyone should be careful with is when you do throw a diaper away, you should definitely not put the tabs on to close the diaper when you throw it away, because that would be permanent and there's no reason to make it on that. Finally, let's talk about two more points here. As far as ointments for diaper rash. So there's a, you're not allowed to smooth memachek, memarech, to smooth creams on. The problem is babies have sometimes raw bottoms. And there might be a heter to just plop some cream on the baby's bottom, and as you put the diaper on and they wiggle around, it will end up getting where it has to go, but not smoothing it on. So why should that be okay? So Shmir Shavuos says, because kilachar yad, and since babies are like a chola, we allow kilachar yad. Rabbi Ribiyat says, no, it's not considered memreach at all. That's one nekuda to keep in mind for diaper rashes. But we don't allow applying skin things for regular people. If you have a skin condition, I get this shadow once in a while. Adults who have skin conditions, could they smooth things on their hands? Under normal circumstances, no. If they have something on their hands, what I sometimes tell them is get a latex glove, put the cream into the latex glove, and put your hand into the glove. And as you wear a glove, it will end up getting where it has to go. Do the same thing with a sock. If there's a problem with the toes or the feet, you can do the same thing. Put some stuff inside a sock or a plastic sock, if you find a plastic sock, and it will get where it has to go without you rubbing it on. As far as walking, where there's no Eruv, and the baby doesn't want to walk home, so first of all, you shouldn't have taken him to shul in the first place if he's not mature enough to walk home consistently. Of course, ideally, if he's not going to walk home from shul, so bribe him, promise him the world. When you get home, we're going to give you so many lollipops, you won't know what to do with it. If that doesn't work, so get a guy, because it's a karmelis, so it's an amir la'akum, it's a shvus shvus, b'makom choli, because it's amir la'akum, and it's a karmelis, and it's makom, the baby's crying, it's like a chole. But that's not good to do either. What you could do, if that option is not available, then you could do pachos pachos midal ramis. Again, we're not talking about... Again, you should avoid it, but you could do pachas pachas da'an amas. And finally, the worst option would be shnai shasua. You and your wife, or you and somebody else, could carry the baby together if you are in such a difficult situation. Obviously, if the baby's in the middle of the street and their car's coming, so you all know what to do. So it's very important to realize that by all cholim she'en bo sakana, amir, let's talk about some medical issues. If there are any cholim she'en bo sakana, there's a she'en bo sakana, amir la'akum is mutu l'chatchila. However, every baby who is uncomfortable is automatically defined as a cholim she'en bo sakana, and for that baby, amir l'nachri will be permitted. What about other drabanans for a baby who's sick? So for example, a nebulizer. So could you use kila'achar yad to turn on an isidrabanan, to turn on an electrical appliance, which let's assume might only be an isidrabanan according to many poskim? So here there's a machlokas. If we allow the heter of kila'achar yad only on things that are fundamentally isidrabanans, or even on things that are midoraisa, if it's shasatcha, could you do it kila'achar yad? Halach lamaisa, if you have no other choice, you have to turn on a nebulizer. You could do it, assuming that it's drabanan, and you do it kila'acha yad, turn on with your elbow. If there's no other way to turn it on and the baby is very, very uncomfortable, it would be much. Of course, if it's a chol sheyesh b'sakana, do whatever you got to do. As far as the halachas of asking a child to do malacha, that we're not going to have time to cover. Only if he has a rash. Only if he has a rash. I'm going to go a few more minutes. If you don't want to stay, you don't have to. Let's do a very important shiur of Dina de Malchus Adina of Rav Shechter. And the rest of the shiur, maybe we'll have to... I'll give you another Chazar shiur later in the week, and I'll send it to you. I'll send you a link to the audio for the rest of the shiur, unless you want to stay for longer. But let's do right now. Dina de Malchus Adina with Rav Shechter. I want to specifically do this because it's there are a lot of different pieces here. I want to just put it together for you. So what's the source for Dina de Malchus Adina? So we have a machlokas in Sanhedrin, Rav and Shmuel, whether Kol Ha'amr B'Parshas Melech is it Merelech Mutribo, it's Taka Mutr, or it's just La'ayim Aleihem to scare people, to disincentivize the fact that they should be asking for a Melech. So we talk a paskin that it's melech mutterbo. The melech has the right to do certain things, including whatever he wants, I guess, and pay taxes. And that is true, you know, as we learned from Shmuel Hanavi, where Shmuel Hanavi criticized Bnei Yisrael and said the melech will do all these things. That was in Eretz Yisrael. So you see clearly that the government has the right, even in Eretz Yisrael, to levy taxes, among other things. The Ran in Adarim, people like to quote, says that there's no taxes in Eretz Yisrael because the right of a government to charge taxes is to charge rent for their land. But since we all own land in Eretz Yisrael, we're all buy them in Eretz Yisrael, the government can charge us rent. However, Rabbi Shechter points out that this Ran doesn't even make its way as a Yesh Omrim in the Shulchan Aruch or the Ramah. The Rambam says specifically, explicitly, that not paying tax would be considered gozel menas hamelech, because the king does have the right. Some suggest that maybe tag, the Mishnah Melech says that maybe taxes is like a milveh. You owe it to the king. And we know that hafkas milveh of a guy is mutter. So maybe according to that logic, one might not have to pay the taxes. But we don't pass, like Shechter says, we don't pass like that Mishnah Lamelech, and therefore that way out of taxes would not be available. It used to be that if you didn't want to pay taxes, you could at least die. If you're dead, you don't have to pay taxes. But even there, it doesn't work anymore. There's still estate taxes, so there's really no way out of taxes. So according to Shechter understands that the chiyuv to pay taxes is not actually because of the rights of the king to charge taxes, which is true, but our taxes suggest, Shechter, that we live in democracies that are welfare states, the taxes are really our way of participating in the shared needs of our community. In Hebrew, that's called Hilchos Shutfin. If we are part of a shutfus, and the majority of the people in the shutfus say, we want to, you know, plant a tree, or we want to build a pool in this shutfus, so all the partners of the shutfus, even if the partners are not happy about it, have to participate. And therefore, if we elected our officials and they make the rule, we will have to follow the rule of the shutfin, the majority of the shutfin say that they want to have public schools. So even though you and I want to send our kids to Jewish day schools and pay private tuitions, we still will have to follow and be swept along with the rule of the shutfus, the federal government shutfus, the state government shutfus, the city government shutfus. We are a part simultaneously of multiple shutfuses, shutfios, and I will have to pay my local, federal, and state taxes because I am a shutef. If I don't, then I'm not stealing from this amorphous thing called government. I'm stealing from every other shutef in my neighborhood who I am not paying my share of that which I should be paying in this shutef. So if, therefore, according to Shechter, if a person doesn't pay their taxes at the right rate, then they're not just asking from this amorphous thing called government. It's not even gzela from Goyim. It's gzela from every other shutef among them, and you're a Jew, so it would be gzela from other Jews as well. That's how Rav Shechter sees tax evasion. Let's move on to the next point. And see, when we apply what are the parameters of Dibud Machlus Adina? So number one, Dibud Machlus Adina is typically assumed in financial, is typically the rule of thumb when you have financial dealings with you and another guy. If it's dealings between you and another Jew, then we apply Choshev Mishpat, not Dina D'Machlus Adina. But if it's you and another guy, you and a guy, then we will apply Dina D'Machlus Adina. Where is Dina D'Machlus Adina important? We find that it's important and it also defines money, meaning there are certain nafkaminas midoraisa, or nafkaminas in general, that we have to have some defined as money. For example, Pidyon Ma'aser Sheni, you have to use a coin of a government that is real money. In Hilchas Ribis, there's Pera, there's Tiva. In order to be defined as Tiva in Hilchas Ribis, there has to be Dina D'Machlus Adina to define it as money. As far as... Okay, that's as far as the importance of defining money. Now, when it comes to Yerusha, there, it's important to remember that we will not follow Dina D'Machlus Adina. And that's for a number of reasons. First of all, because Yerusha is, by definition, between two Jews. So we don't follow Dina D'Machlus Adina between two Jews. Number two, the Rambam has this mystery pasuk, this drasha that he made up, presumably we don't know where it came from, that says, by Yerusha, it says, chok mishpat, that doesn't just have a din of a mishpat, it also has a din of a chok. It's like, you know, I'll call it, you know, yoredeya, dikadin, it's isur, not just mamonis, and therefore we don't follow, if, you know, Dina D'Machlus Adina is that you have to work on Saturday, it doesn't mean a Jew is allowed to work on Saturday. Dina D'Machlus Adina is limited only to Choshev Mishpat, to financial issues, and Yerusha has an Isser component, an Isser dimension as well, and not just Momonos. Therefore, we will not apply Dina D'Machlus Adina to Yerusha. So it's important to write a halachic will. Next. Rav Hankin says that there are certain situations where, let's talk about a few cases where we will apply Dina D'Machlus Adina between Jews. So Rav Hankin says, that if there's a Dina D'Machlus Adina of Letikon HaMedina, where the point of this law is to take care of people, and the government has to take care of Jews and non-Jews alike. So for example, rent control, minimum wage, bankruptcy, those are established Dina D'Machlus Adinas that are Letikon HaMedina, and that would apply even between two Jews. Another case where we'll apply the... the Dina de Machlokes, the Dina between two Jews, is pointed out by the Shach. The Shach says that even if both parties are Jewish, if the halacha is silent about a given scenario, if halacha is silent, then there's no Torah to ask, there's no Chosh Mishpat to follow, so you'll follow Dina de Machlokes Dina. That will be the arbiter in the absence of any psak of Torah. Chazanish says there's no such thing as a halacha question that doesn't have a psak of the Torah, of the Shulchan Aruch. And then Rosh Hashanah, I think, liked that Chazanish point. Another scenario, situation that the Shach suggests where we will apply Dina de Machlokes Dina even between two Jews is, let's say, for example, you have a seller and you have a buyer, but the seller has many clients, many customers. You have B&H. You go to B&H, and he's going to say, okay, you're a Yid, I'm going to give you the warranty or the, you know, the dinim of Nakachtos, that's Al Pichos Shemishpat. Everybody else who's going to come into my store, he's going to have a 30-day, you know, 30-day warranty, you know, like, that's my public warranty policy. So that's not going to work, because then every person who's going to walk into the store, he's going to say, oh, you're Jewish, you're not Jewish, you're Jewish, you're not Jewish, and that's not going to work. So clearly the umdana of walking into B&H is that he's going to treat everybody with the same blanket rules of whatever the Dina of the Dina is, because there's an umdana, that's the Yisod, there's an umdana that if you didn't stipulate what the halachas will be, we're going to follow the umdana of the Minhag Medina, and it's going to be ke'ilu your masa, because if Mr. B&H and I are masna what our return policy should be when I buy from him, so we'll follow that tonight. But if in the absence of a tonight, so... for example, where he has so many different clients, Jewish and non-Jewish, it's clear the undana will be that it will be ke'ilu hisna, that we should follow whatever the minhag hamakom is, or the dina de malchusa dina. Now let's talk about the second half of that shir, and that is... Sorry? But you never made it tonight. Who made... That's the chiddush that we're saying, that by the fact that you walked in, and that if he only had Jews, then he might not, that might only apply if you made this tonight. But since it's understood that it's not reasonable for him to say, you're Jewish, you can have this policy, you're Jewish, you're not Jewish, you can have that policy, since that's not reasonable, we'll assume that by walking into the store, you're accepting upon yourself, it's ki'ilu hisna, and then you'll be bound by that store policy, whatever the umdana, or whatever their store policy would be. Let's talk about mesira. So, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Makin, Bezdin, Makin, Ve'onshin, Shlom, and Hadin. And it's important to realize, just like Bezdin can be Makin, Ve'onshin, Shlom, and Hadin, so too, the Ran points out that a non-Jewish government can also be Makin, Ve'onshin, Shlom, and Hadin. That means if a government wants to say that we think that stealing is so bad, we want to kill everybody who steals, the government has every right to do that and to enforce that. Not only that, but the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Gimel, points out a story that Reb Elazar, the son of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, was hired by the Roman government to find Jewish criminals and to give the death penalty to robbers. And Eliyahu HaNavi comes and meets with him and says, what are you doing? And he says, I'm getting rid of the thorns, the bad Jews, among the good Jews. And Eliyahu HaNavi says, it's not such a great thing. Let Hashem take care of that. You shouldn't. But he didn't say it's aser. It seems from that Gemara, as the Rishonim point out, that it is permitted to turn over Jews to a Roman government, even if it means that the Roman government is going to give a death penalty for theft. Even that is mutter. So that's not Mesira. What is Mesira? So let's get a little bit of an understanding. If Mesira, the Isra of Mesira, when you're not allowed to turn somebody over, is if the person didn't do anything wrong. If the person didn't violate a halacha, stealing from anybody is wrong, is asur. So if a person steals, you're allowed to turn them over to the authorities, and the authorities will do whatever the authorities think you should do, whatever the law is for this punishment, even if it's more than what Torah says. However, if a person didn't do anything that halakha sees as wrong, if you violate some environmental law, you produce too much pollution. So there's no halakha against... We love the environment. But there's no halakha specifically outlawing, asering, creating pollution, so you can't... The person didn't violate an isser of any level. You have no right to be moser that person to the government because the person didn't violate anything. If the person violated anything that would be asur according to halacha, then you could turn them over to the secular government, even if the secular government's punishment is vastly greater than Torah's punishment. another limitation, meaning when is it also asur to do mesira? When is mesira, what we call mesira, that is the mesira ha'asura? So again, case number one would be if the person did something that's not a violation of any isur. Number two is, let's say the person would get punished even more than the law states that they should get. So let's say the punishment is you go to jail for 5 years. But it happens to be that there are certain jails, you don't just go to jail for 5 years, they also beat up Jews in that jail. They beat up people who do, tax evasion in that jail. So if you would turn in somebody that's tax evasion, not only are you subjecting them to five years of jail, that's okay, that's the rule of the land, but they also can get beat up. That is not what the rule of the land is. The rule of the land is not that they should get beaten up. That would be Mesira Ha'asura. That would be where it would be Taka Asur. However, if there would be, so now let's talk about when there really is an Isra of Mesira. For example, they didn't do anything that is Asur, it's just illegal but not Asur, or they didn't do any, or they would get punished more than they really rightfully should. Nevertheless, even there, the Gra in the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Eidos seems to say that if it would be a Chil Hashem, that a Jew wouldn't testify, the Jew is subpoenaed by the judge and he refuses to testify, and the judge knows that the only reason why he's not testifying is because he's a Jew, and because of Jewish, that's why that would be Chil Hashem. Then, just like by Aveda, returning Avedas Akum, in B'makom Chil Hashem, we would return Avedas Akum. So too, Mesira would be Mutter B'makom Chil Hashem. If there'd be a Chil Hashem and that you don't testify, then there would be no Isra of Mesira. The Shulchan Aruch also allows Mesira in two more cases, meaning even if it's Mesira Ha'asura, like they would go to jail and get beaten up, which even the law doesn't say that they should get beaten up. If somebody's Meitzer as Harabim, a pedophile, a con artist, somebody who's an abuser, so there, even if he'll get beaten up, let's say they beat up pedophiles in prison. So a pedophile deserves 5 years, 10 years in prison. But he's going to get beaten up? I don't care. If he's a pedophile, he's Meitzer as Harabim, he pains other people. So then, even if you will end up getting beaten up in prison, it will still be permitted to do this Mesira, which typically would be Asur, because he's getting more than the law ought to require. And secondly, if somebody's Maka as Tavero, which as Rabbi Shatter pointed out, if a teacher would notice, or a rabbi would notice, that a family member, a child, a wife, is bruised or something like that, that would also be that the hitter would be Maka as Tavero, that would also be warrant Mesira Ha'asura, meaning even to be sent to a prison where they'd get more than just a prison sentence, but even get beaten up in prison, that would also be permitted if he's Maka as Tavero. Okay. What? Beside, Makas Chavero is itself Asur. And since it's also Makas Chavero, it deserves to even do a Mesir that would typically be Asur. Okay. Do you want to stop here? Or it's a long time. Go, you want to do another Shir now? Who wants another Shir right now? Okay, so let's stop now. And Bez Hashem, I'll follow up with you on the second half.